Welcome to the ERB podcast, where we love to talk about books. At the ERB, we believe that life and faith is nurtured by the habit of reading. We've invited a diversity of writers, thinkers, and leaders to talk with us about the books they're reading, because reading matters, and so do great conversations. C. Christopher Smith is the founding editor of the Englewood Review of Books. Joel Wentz is our producer, and I'm your host, Jen Pollock-Michelle. Heather Lanier is a poet, essayist, teacher, speaker, and thrift store shopper. She's the author of the memoir Raising a Rare Girl, a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, as well as a forthcoming poetry collection titled Psalms of Unknowing. She is an assistant professor of creative writing at Rowan University and lives with her family in New Jersey. And you can find out more about Heather at www.heatherlanierwriter.com. And Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Jen. It's great to be here.
Katie Manning is going to be also in this conversation. She's the author of Her Reverent and other poetry collections and has received numerous prizes and awards for her work. She is the founder and editor-in-chief of Whale Road Review and professor of writing at Point Loma Nazarene University. And I can't believe that I forgot when we jumped on this call that she lives in San Diego, because how can you forget that someone lives in such a beautiful place? She lives with her spouse and her sons in San Diego, and you can find her online at www.katiemanningpoet.com. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'm really excited about this episode because, as I was sharing with both of you before we started recording, this is actually our first poetry episode, which is just a huge work of repair because Chris Smith, founding editor of the Englewood Review of Books, loves poetry, is a regular poetry reader, reviews poetry in the review, and is promoting poets and celebrating poets, you know, when they, you know, famous poets as their, the days of their birthdays. And so it's great to finally actually be talking about poetry. But one of the first questions I thought of was, you know, both of you, presumably, I mean, you have advanced degrees, you're teaching, so you write in a variety of different genres, but I'm curious if you would call yourself more primarily a poet or just more generally a writer. And so, Katie, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I love this question. I think I am someone who gets really irritated when I see poet and writer separated. Oh. I'm always like, poets are writers. But the more that I thought about this, I was thinking, I do consider myself a poet first and primarily. And it's, I think, because I started writing poetry before I could write. I started composing poems when I was about 4 years old, and my granny wrote them down for me. And so I think there is something in me that is a poet beyond and apart from my identity as a writer. And also, the more I thought about this, I thought, when I sit down to write, even if it ends up being a lyric essay or a piece of flash fiction, when I start, I'm thinking of it as a poem. I'm thinking of it as a prose poem, or, you know, I'm still my poet self when I sit down to write whatever it is that I'm writing. So I'm definitely a poet first and primarily. And I love that question. So thank you for asking.
Well, I'm hoping that you have, you know, the poems that Granny recorded. Do you?
I definitely know the first poem that I composed.
Oh, well, can you share it with us?
I can.
So, okay, good.
So Katie Henson, age 4.
Okay.
This is The Never Ending Story, which I definitely ripped off the title, but I was 4.
So. Good writers, they steal, right? I mean, they borrow.
Certainly. Well, and the funny thing is, I remember when I was a little bit older encountering the movie first and going, oh, that has the same title as my poem. So I wasn't even aware that I had taken the title. I'm sure I heard it, you know, in a preview or something. It must have been. Okay, my poem. The never-ending story really never ends for someone who I really love really is my friend.
Oh my goodness. Yes, claps all around.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you have that record and that Granny thought to write it down.
It makes me very happy that my granny wrote yes. down when I was
yes. four. I mean, what an kind of, I think, affirmation of something that you're doing that feels important and valuable.
Yeah.
Okay, Heather, how about you? When you think about your work and your identity, what do you consider yourself? Poet, writer, both?
I was a poet first. And then, I mean, I was writing poems in high school and college, and I studied poetry primarily, but they didn't have creative nonfiction in academia back then. This was like the late 90s. It was just fiction or poetry. It was like, you know, are you going to make stuff up or are you going to write some poems? And I was a terrible make stuff upper. And I wanted to write about real life. And so I just figured the genre of poetry is where that happens. And not all my poems are autobiographical now. Poetry gives me the space to make stuff up. But I started when I found creative nonfiction after college, I started writing a lot of prose. So so I guess I considered I was first a poet, and now I do both creative nonfiction and poetry. And I do list them separately because for me, poems, it feels like a very different mind to work in a poem than when I'm working in an essay that's like very idea driven, or if I'm working in like a book length memoir that's very story driven and I'm having to lay down a lot of story. Poetry just feels like a different container and requires, I don't know, like painting with words less than more so than building this more, it's not that it's more complicated. It just feels like I have to let go of a certain kind of logic in poetry that will otherwise weigh it down. So I don't know. Yeah. So I was chronologically a poet first, and now I'm both a creative nonfiction writer and a poet.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And you guys both touched on a little bit how you got started and certainly share anything more about that. But what about the first experience of reading poetry, or like the first experience, you know, or set of experiences that you can remember, even the first poem that you might remember having read and reread for pleasure? What was that like? And Heather, I'll start with you.
I think it probably is similar for many people. It was Shel Silverstein's books, you know, like A Light in the Attic, Where the Sidewalk Ends, and just reading those poems again and again. And I was obviously learning meter, you know, I was like learning the rhythm of poems and like the sing-songiness that sometimes they will have. And then I remember like sitting on the bus and looking at the rules for riding the yellow school bus, and not really, only later did I realize I was kind of scanning the meter of them in my mind. So it was like, you know, keep hands in, arms inside, this sort of just reading those rules like they were a poem. But the very first sort of more grown up encounter of poetry I had was in AP Spanish with Senor Benorchek, because Senor told us that the AP Spanish exam was way too hard and we shouldn't even try. And so there was this book of Leonard Cohen poems in his class, and it was translations in English and Spanish. And I had not heard of Leonard Cohen. I had not heard his music, but I read his poems, and they were so simple and so accessible, but written in this like beautiful meter and very surprising, sometimes surprising rhyme. And I just fell in love, and I thought, oh, we can write poems like that, where we sort of speak plainly, but in a way that makes an experience fresh with very simple words, like everyday words, but in a way that surprised me. So Leonard Cohen was my first favorite poet.
Mm-hmm. That actually reminds me of AP French. I hadn't even really thought about that, but I thought, oh yeah, I remember like I don't even honestly remember who we were reading, but you know, the very sort of specific kind of stresses and, you know, beats in a line, and and finding that it felt very analytical. I guess I like that. I guess there was a logic that I sort of liked about that. So interesting where we can encounter poetry. What about you? Katie, do you remember a first poem that you loved?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. And, you know, I remember when I was very young, I had books of, you know, nursery rhymes, and I was obsessed with this book of Christmas carols that I would read over and over. And then in early elementary school, I kept checking out this book of holiday poems, and it was all of, you know, every holiday, you know, kind of in this book. But the first specific poem that I remember reading over and over was, I have it here. It was The Cremation of Sam McGee by Robert Service. And my honors teacher, and it was either fourth or fifth grade, he had us memorize the first part of the poem that becomes the refrain that also repeats at the very end of the poem. And he had us memorize and recite it in class. And we all recited the beginning of it. And there was something about it that I just loved. And I loved the entire poem. And I think it probably appealed to my very dark sense of humor that I've had all of my life since a very young age. Because if you're familiar with it, it's this narrative poem where this guy is freezing. He's from Tennessee, but he's in the Arctic and he's freezing. And he makes this his companion promise to cremate him if he dies. And then, of course, he dies that night. And the companion is like carrying him around for several days. And then he finds this abandoned ship or something. And he puts, you know, his dead companion in the boiler, but then it's very spooky and there's, you know, weird smoke and stuff. And so he opens it to peek in, and Sam, the guy who's supposed to be dead, tells him to close the door because he's going to let the cold in. And it's the first time he's been warm since he left Tennessee. And so it's this long narrative poem, and it ends in this, you know, spooky, but then not, it's hilarious kind of way. And I just loved it. I thought it was so funny. So I read it over and over, and I memorized that first part of it. And it's still something that I think of sometimes, because I'm someone who grew up in Phoenix. And like, when I moved to a cold place for the first time and had my first snow day in grad school, I was thinking of Sam McGee. So it's a poem that it like stuck with me for, you know, for life. It has stayed with me. And yeah, I love that. I love that that poem from my, you know, one of my earliest poems that captured my attention is still hanging out with me.
And it speaks to poetry as an occasion for delight, too. You know, I think so many people can think of poetry as, you know, the thing you have to work really hard to understand, you know, and you sort of exercise a lot of grit to get through it. I mean, actually, prior to recording, we were talking to our producer, Joel Wentz, who admitted that he's not a huge poetry reader, and possibly because he started with T.S. Eliot. Not that T.S. Eliot can't be an occasion for delight as well. But I think so often we are sort of warned off from poetry because we expect an experience that is not at all what you just described, you know? Yeah. So I'm so glad that you shared that. Heather, we're going to talk about both of your collections, your most recent collections. Heather, yours is forthcoming. When is it actually coming out? Psalms of Unknowing.
September 12th. So by the time this airs, it'll be out.
Great.
Probably. Yeah.
It'll be out by the time this episode is out, most likely. So your collection is called Psalms of Unknowing. And I would love for you to talk to readers about the genesis of the project, and specifically how you arranged it. And anything else you want to share about, you know, your aims, your hopes, your experience of writing it.
Yeah, well, it came, I mean, the poems in this book are the result of 15 years of writing poems. So I wouldn't say that, you know, I certainly didn't know that I was writing a book and it was called Psalms of Unknowing and it was going to be in these four sections. It's just that I've been writing and publishing poetry for over 10, 15 years. And was getting to the point where I really wanted to know, you know, if I could put it together as a whole book and what poems would be in that book and what poems wouldn't be in that book. And so I had gathered all these poems together and noticed different themes. And you'll see themes about motherhood and pregnancy and motherhood and themes of grief and loss and themes of wrestling with different political questions and struggles. And there's also what I call the Jesus poems. Like there's just these poems about Jesus where I'm fascinated by some line of, you know, a moment in the gospel that I think is kind of curious and fun to think about. So when I was putting together the poems, I kept thinking, well, what do I do with the Jesus poems? You know, like literary poetry sometimes doesn't embrace overtly Christian iconography. So I guess I'll just put them all over here, like in section three or something. And I looked through the book and I was like, this isn't working. I don't quite know why. And then I did see a call from Monkfish, which is my publisher, seeking literary and spiritual work. So work that is both literary and religiously related or spiritually related. And I thought, oh, actually, it's lovely to know that such a publisher exists and that there is a literary publisher that's interested in work that would be diving into different religious traditions. And so I thought, what if I stopped hiding the Jesus poems? What if I started looking at this book through the lens of someone who's a spiritual seeker? And everything made sense after that, because I realized that the through line of all of my work has always been spiritual questions. So the first section, often I think a lot of the sections will work with two different sort of paradox or a paradox of opposites. You know, the first section is the speaker is pregnant, and there's also poems about death and wrestling with loss. And so there's the like contrast of life and death, you know, and what does it mean to bring someone into this world knowing that, man, the contract of life is that we also have to lose it. And so that's the first section. And then things kind of progress from there. But everything is, once I realized that everything was sort of filtered through these different questions of trying to seek the divine in different ways, whether that's through seeking one or creating one's own religious language or diving into actual biblical stories, the collection came together as a feminist journey of spiritual seeking.
I'm thankful for you to put it so, you know, concisely like that. It's really fun, actually. I have to say I'm not a poet, and I should have really thought about, I mean, I guess I hadn't really considered the question of what it's like to put together a book of poetry and how much time could be represented in such a project. Mm-hmm. Now, it'll be interesting to talk to you, Katie. I wonder, we'll save it. We'll let our readers hang on for a little bit more suspense, because maybe your project developed a little bit differently. I don't know. But and then to think about the serendipities that sort of happen as you see things kind of coalesce around themes.
Yeah, so that's what you're looking for. I don't know if Katie had that experience, but some people do write books where they're like, now I'm writing a book of poems, and this is the project, and they're all going to be, you know, about this theme. In this case, this was very much a collection of things, of works, poems I had written over the course of the decade or more. And it was, what you're looking for as a poet is like trying to create the third thing. So you have this poem over here, and you have this poem over here. And if I put them side by side, what's the third thing they make? And then like, how can you just keep growing that third thing so that the whole book becomes this new thing that the poems together are all contributing to? If it works well, then it is pretty serendipitous. And it's exciting to see when poems get placed next to each other, the larger conversation they start to make.
Mm.
Katie, I want to hear about what Katie's process was like.
Yeah. Let's go. Tell us about her reverent.
Yeah. So I guess I am someone who wrote in a project. So I guess the impetus for my project was a couple of things. One is I needed a project. I had just finished my dissertation. I had just had a baby. I was starting my first full-time faculty position. And I thought, I might never write again. It was just this kind of transition in all of these ways. And so I knew I needed to give myself an assignment if I wanted to keep a writing practice. And when I thought about what I wanted to write and what was driving me at the time, I thought about how furious I was at people who take language from the Bible out of context and use it as a weapon against mm-hmm. other people. And so that was kind of the driving, you know, seed of the collection. And I ended up using the last chapter of each book of the Bible as a word bank to create the poems in this collection. And I didn't anticipate that it was going to be as much work as it was, mm. it took as long as it did. But I started this project in 2012.
And oh, wow.
It was published this April. So it was, and I worked on other projects in between. So it wasn't only this book. I had other collections published and other, you know, chapbook projects that I worked on in between. But yeah, it was a good project. It was challenging to me. And it definitely evolved over time. I started it in a very angry way, I would say. Mm-hmm. It definitely is something that I think of as kind of protest art. At some point while I was doing it, I realized that my process of kind of using the last chapter of each book as a word bank, it sort of resembled the practice of Lectio Divina, where mm-hmm. I'm reading something over and over and sort of seeing what jumps out and kind of meditating on these texts. And so that was really fascinating because that wasn't something that I had intended from the start, but it kind of was revealed to me as I went. And the biggest thing that I've been sort of fascinated about is how readers interpret the poems. I'm so fascinated to hear how other people receive them.
Mm-hmm. And maybe, Katie, you can also just explain just the title, because I think it ties into the process that you're describing.
Yeah. So I have a little note in the beginning, a kind of a process statement. And at the end of it, I say, this is either the most heretical or the most reverent thing that I've ever created. And so the title is The Portmanteau of Heretical and Reverent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, that process of Lectio Divina is an act of reverencing the scriptures. And so I think it's a really fascinating project. I would be curious, you used the word chapbook, and I saw that both, I didn't actually look it up, and I'm almost at the end of my MFA, and I thought, I don't think I've ever heard that term. So do you, one of you guys, want to talk about the difference between a chapbook and a poetry collection?
Sure.
Okay.
We can tag team it. So typically a full length collection is longer than a chapbook. A chapbook can be a variety of lengths. Often it's maybe around 20-ish pages, but they can vary quite a bit. Historically, a chapbook was something that was a little more handmade, kind of a hand-bound, artistically created thing. Nowadays, chapbooks can be perfect bound. They can look very similar to a full length book, but the distinction still stands that they tend to be shorter. They're often a more unified collection around a more specific kind of theme.
Mm. What's the experience, maybe Heather, because you've written, mm-hmm. I mean, both of you have written both. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the experience of assembling this collection, Psalms of Unknowing versus, mm-hmm. you know, some of the chapbooks you've published.
Yeah, actually, so I have a chapbook, three chapbooks, and one is forthcoming later, but they all do have themes, very specific themes. So there's the chapbook that will come out next year is called Erasing the Book of Pregnancy, and it is about the experience of being pregnant and kind of, there are these erasure poems from these very condescending pregnancy manuals, you know, because there's so much weird pregnancy advice out there. But that's not really a project I would ever do for like a 60-page poetry collection. It's like, here are now 60 pages of pregnancy poems. It would feel like the book was keeling over from a very big belly. I think that a good full length collection will be typically more braided of different threads. You know, you'll have to have a couple different kinds of threads woven in. Now, there are authors or there are poets who managed to sustain us through 80 pages of poetry. Victoria Chang comes to mind. I'm just so impressed by her books and the projects of them. But I found that I needed to have more than one thing in this collection, but they all needed to be still belonging together, you know? So I guess it's more like a chorus, you know, like people are singing different parts, but there's some harmony there. If there is discord, it feels artistic or it feels right, not rather than like jarring to the ear. So yeah, I think a full length collection, readers want some surprise. They want some movement, maybe some changes in voice and changes of subject matter for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great orientation for people who are new to reading poetry, that I think a lot of people would maybe sort of assume, oh, okay, I'm going to get Psalms of Unknowing and or Her Reverent, and I'm going to just flip around and, you know, choose a few poems here and there, which I don't know, maybe you would say is a fine way to try it, but they might be missing the experience of the movement of the arc of the, you know, the resonances that are supposed to be occurring. What do you guys think about people who want to just sort of pick and choose in a collection? Are you like, great, I'm just glad you picked it up?
Yes, absolutely. I'm pro neurodiversity experiences of reading. You know, like our minds all work differently, and however you want to read a book is, it's good to honor a reader's creating the experience of reading through different means. I mean, anytime some person picks up a book, they're recreating the book with their own mind. So if they read it out of order, that's fine. Absolutely. But there is an arc that a writer has shaped for you. So it can be interesting to also try to look at what that arc might be.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to listening to an album. So, yes. you know that the musician has put together this album intentionally in this way, and the songs are maybe going to connect in a certain way and sound great if you listen to it all together. But of course you can listen to the songs individually, and that's okay too, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's not wrong to listen to or to read poems out of context, but it will be a rich experience if you do read the book all in one, or, you know, in the order that the author intended.
Mm-hmm. And this is just sort of speaking to the subjectivity of the exercise, right? Of receiving art, that, you know, so much. I mean, even when you could read a book at a particular moment in time and then 10 years later pick it up and it means something very different to you, because of the kind of life experiences that you bring into the reading experience. So, and I'm sure our listeners know that because they're great readers. Well, I am excited for you guys to have an opportunity to read some of the poems in your collection. I very selfishly chose poems that I wanted to hear you read, because I was able to preview your work in preparation for this episode. But certainly if there's another poem that you would prefer to read, I'm absolutely okay with that as well. Heather, in your collection, Psalms of Unknowing, I would really love to hear you read the poem Free Bible in Your Own Language, and also Agnostic Says Morning Prayer. And maybe you could, you know, if you want to comment on them before or after, where they're located in the collection, or maybe how they speak to the larger project, you're welcome to do that as well.
Yeah. So Free Bible in Your Own Language is technically the second poem, but the first poem that begins the first section. So there's one poem that stands apart from all the other sections. It did come from an experience of walking along a campus mall and literally seeing a sign that read Free Bible in Your Own Language. And there was a table of different Bibles. And I was in the process of returning to attending attending an Episcopal church after 10 years away. And I was raised fundamentalist Baptist, and I was trying to re-experience the divine through a Christian lens without feeling a reaction to a lot of the patriarchal language that was disturbing to me as a child. And so I just enjoyed that phrase, like Free Bible in Your Own Language, and like thinking about the possibilities of a Bible that can be written just in my own language. So here it is. Call me Doubting Tom, but have you heard my language? How I pepper the day with, oh shits, of running late and roadkill. And does a book on your table filter fables through 1980s pop lines? Shout, shout, let it all out. What about shunyata, that wide bell of a Buddhist word, emptiness, splattered flat on a blank page like a smacked fly? In my Bible, several vacant pages follow. Let's shut one. Then, like a musical greeting card, open it again. Any monks chanting muddled nirvana? How about a bongo and a flute? A woman at the top of a redwood rapping the number of steps it took her to reach now. Only text, Adam's rib and how Eve was turned from it. This is wrong. In my language, God takes two of his own, blows bone dust across a field like seeds, plants trees, roots grow into legs. Upon what, you ask, is the book written? Give me some space, a quiet walk in the grass, unburdened by your kiosk of Korean, Finnish, French. With my footprints bending the blades, I'll write a psalm of unknowing, knowing the sun will erase it, will call it back into straight, green, speechless strands.
Beautiful.
So that's, thank you.
Thank
that's
you.
That poem.
Yes.
So because the book covers a lot of years of writing of poems, it also spans a lot of years of discovery and seeking. And so when I returned to an actual church, I felt very welcome in an Episcopal church and felt very much like I could be there as a person looking for God, not a person who had to like dogmatically declare anything. Like I could be there in a space of unknowing. The title of the book also kind of winks at the cloud of unknowing, that anonymous text that became foundational for the practice of centering prayer, which is a Christian meditation that I practice. It's interesting that you chose this poem, which was written in a very similar time. So there are other poems that I think are more rooted in belief and in a more certainty about and comfort with biblical, with being with the Bible, I'd say. But here's another poem coming out of a space of trying to figure out how to find the divine in a history of encountering the Bible from a patriarchal lens. So this is called Agnostic Says Morning Prayer. We glory be to your Father, your Son, and the mistiest of you, lilting between leaf edges like the fog, smoking the hills this church is wedged between. Trinity, you're a strange family of one body and no women. Outside, the school buses screech to stop, putter waiting, and we say, as it was in the beginning, this is why I want you back, want what some call your second coming, for revision. Every writer's love-hate obsession, kingdom, father, eternal redemption, I want you to rewrite the language of heaven. And what would I have you say? Make it about fog, maybe. Call God a mountain, a mother, I don't know, second Jesus, surprise me. Melt the stained glass in all these windows as we leap out, breathe pine, are caught by angels or very strong women.
That was beautiful. Actually, it was interesting. I mean, I chose those as I was just reading through the collection, but I can hear the resonance even between the poems that I chose, you know, the question
of
language.
Yeah, they're very different. They're in different places. Yeah. The first was in section one and the one you asked is in section four, actually. So it's interesting.
Well, good. Yeah. Well,
and
I'm really...
Can I just say, Heather, it's amazing to hear your work and I can't wait to read more of it.
Well, thank you. Well, I mean, yours already sounds fantastic, so I can't wait to hear some poems now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought we could do the gospel poems because I thought that language would be perhaps most familiar to, and especially because you're taking the last chapter, so it's the resurrection accounts or some aspect of it. And I think that's going to be really wonderful for our listeners to hear. So I know that's four poems, but
they're little, they go by quickly. Yeah. I'll go ahead and read them and then I can say a little bit about them maybe. And I guess I'll start by saying the titles of these poems are partial anagrams of the books that they come from. So, the book of what? A tomb at dawn is like lightning. Heaven came down from heaven and became like dead men. Now I have told you the end. The book of Ma. A mother might go to a tomb trembling and bewildered and ask a young man in a white robe who is not there, "Are you afraid?" The book of El. While living, the Lord told all to believe like linen lying still. Then he rolled away early. Still himself, the Lord startled all, saying, "Look at my flesh, like broiled fish." And he took it and ate it and left them blessed. The book of On. It happened this way. Fish got on the boat and caught Jesus, but they did not realize that Jesus loved fish. When the fish saw fire, they were torn. When Jesus had finished eating, he said, "You know that I love you. Do you love me?"
So, oh, I'm very excited to hear you talk about this.
I always laugh when I'm going to talk about my own poems, because I once heard somebody say that there's nothing worse than hearing poets try to explain their own poems.
And you can't annotate your own poem.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's the work of other people. Other people are supposed to, you know, grapple with your poems. So I won't try to explain my own poems, but I will say it's fun for me to think of what I was doing as sort of using scripture as a little bit of a Rorschach test for myself. So, I was newly mothering as I was working on this collection. And so I've got all sorts of threads of mothers and women and bodies and, and definitely a grappling with God. And, you know, the identity of God, the nature of God, kind of going all through. And the nature of children and kind of what that means in terms of blessing and cursing. And there's a lot going on in there. So there are different kind of threads going through. And I also was kind of delighted by how fish showed up as almost a comical thread. I shouldn't have been surprised, I suppose, that fish show up frequently, because that's, you know, a thing that you'd play with. But I didn't realize it until after I had completed the poems. And because I was working on the poems over a long stretch of time, you know, in the initial drafting, I wasn't necessarily thinking about them in a connected way. So it was fun to kind of work that out as I was revising. And so there's that layer of it, but then there's also the layer of readers encountering then the poems, and the ways that readers are interpreting them are just, as I mentioned before, so fascinating to me, because then that's another layer of that sort of Rorschach test for what people are seeing in them, and the poems are kind of reading whoever is encountering them, right? And mm-hmm. the associations that they're bringing to the text. And some of them are, you know, a little bit deliberately arranged so that mm-hmm. they have that kind of multiple possibilities of interpretation. I find that I tend to be very playful with language anyway in poems. And I think this project allowed for a lot of that, both in terms of, I guess, some joyful play, but also even when I'm at my angriest and my most, you know, the most protesting, I still have a playful way of approaching that.
There's a little bit of Sam McPhee in your project, actually, I think, now to think back to, like, you know, the furnace door opening, and he's like, "Close it, close the door, it's cold in here."
That's funny, because I had not ever thought of that, and I only thought of the cremation of Sam McGee because...
Or McGee, often, McGee.
Yeah. But yes, I think, as I said, I have had a dark sense of humor since my youth, and I have no doubt that that was part of shaping my dark humor. So,
I think the project of reading scripture and creating that word bank and then putting it into poems forces you into the very the most concrete realities in those texts, right? You can't fill up a poem with a whole bunch of abstraction. It's just not going to, it's not going to really be a poem. And I am always surprised at how often we can read the Bible for the kind of like large ideas, the argument, right? Instead of like really like the fish and the linen shroud and the stone. And so I think that's kind of, there's a really wonderful way in which it sort of refocuses our attention on those concrete realities within scripture. So thank you. I think there's a reverence there too. And maybe the Samaghi part is is it heretical to be funny? I actually was just reading the book of Job and reading it in Robert Alter's translation. And I'm like, did I read this in any other translation where one of the interlocutors' words were compared to flatulence? Like, I don't know if Alter preserved that and other English translators didn't. I thought that is really funny. And I'd like to hear somebody preach about that.
My husband is a priest, and sometimes he will remind me, like, that foot was actually a euphemism for another body part, and sometimes it's a foot and sometimes it's not. Like, it's fascinating to learn what different translators will do.
Mm-hmm. My son was telling me, and I don't know why they were talking about the Book of Esther in his New Testament class. He and this is not even at a Christian university. He's at McGill University in Montreal, but that the scepter in the Book of Esther may not actually be a scepter. Oh. Every time he extended the scepter, it might've been something else. So I thought that's fascinating. I've never heard that either. Oh gosh, I know we could go on forever and ever, and Joel, our producer, will kill me if I don't wrap this up very soon. So I'm going to have to skip a few questions. I think it would be really wonderful. Let's just do the advice question, because I do think that we're going to have listeners who aren't familiar with poetry. It's just not the thing that they reach for. They're intimidated by it. And I can imagine that many of the students that you work with are in that exact, you know, share those kinds of apprehensions. How do you talk to somebody about who might express a desire, I'd like to try poetry, I just don't know how or where to start, or what the reading experience, like what kind of reading experience I should pursue, or what skills do I need? Katie, let's start with you. What do you say to a person like that?
So usually when I encounter people who are maybe resistant to poetry, or who want to try poetry and haven't liked it before, I assume that they have not found the right poems yet. Or they have been told that they have to read poetry in a certain way. So if it is the case that they've been told that they have to read poems and find the meaning, then something that I go through with my students when we're first starting a poetry class is just showing them a variety of poems. Like, here are poems that are trying to tell you a story. This poem is clearly trying to paint you a picture. You know, poems are trying to play with sound, or poems are, you know, they're trying to do so many different things. And so if you're trying to read poems as if they're all doing one thing, and it's to give you a meaning, as if they're all, you know, here's my thesis statement, then that's doing a disservice to poetry. Poetry is so much larger than that and so much more varied. And so often, you know, as you heard me say to Joel earlier when we were talking to him, I will say to people, you know, hey, if you want to tell me some things that you love, I would love to, you know, give you some poems that you might enjoy, because I think there are poems for everybody. Mm. There are poems about just about anything. So, you know, there are topics that that you will find that, you know, that you might love. And there are different, there's so many different kinds of poems. Mm. So if you don't like poems that rhyme, there are poems that are in other forms. Or if you, you know, if you don't like poems that are long, they're super short poems, you know, they're poems that just do so many different things. So I do think there are poems for everyone.
I was going to second all that. I just thought it was great. It's really important.
Mm. Do you, well, just Katie, really quickly, do you have a particular poet you find yourself recommending more than another?
I don't know that I have a specific poet that I recommend more than others. I do tend to recommend Gwendolyn Brooks a lot.
That's good.
I think she's so readable. You know, she's not intimidating in her language. And yeah, I think there are so many different Gwendolyn Brooks poems that seem to be good for different kinds of people. So I do think I end up pulling out Gwendolyn Brooks for a lot of different people.
Okay, great. Thank you. Heather,
do you have any other
advice that, you know, different or somebody that you would recommend? What poets do you reach for when you're offering?
Well, I guess I second all of what Katie's saying about different, there's many different kinds of poems, and even any poet will find a collection, an anthology, and many of the poems won't resonate with even ourselves, you know, that just because you're a poet doesn't mean all the poetry works for you. So I always like to use the metaphor that like reading a poem is like landing on a new planet, and you don't really know what it's about, and you don't know where you are, and just sort of enjoy the fact that you're on this whole new world and you don't know the names of things yet, and just sort of take in the wonder, you know, the wonder of having a different kind of gravity and the wonder of not knowing the names of the plants and pointing out curious things. I think that space of just open curiosity is helpful when you enter into a poem. And then it takes a few readings to start to understand what this poem is, what its project is, and how it might be trying to reach you or affect you. My own favorite recently has been Danusha Lemiris's work, who wrote a book called Bonfire Opera and has, I think, another collection. And I love Danusha's work because the early lines of the poem feel really inviting. You're like, oh yes, I'm very much on board with what you're saying. I understand where we are. I know who the speaker is. I know what they're trying to communicate. And then as the poem goes on, you start to enter these like transcendent places of insight and beauty. And I'm always amazed that she takes us to those places, starting with such very accessible gestures, like where the language is just very accessible in the beginning. And by the end, I feel like we've been taken somewhere really new in a very beautiful way. So that's someone I might recommend if people are resistant. I think Billy Collins's, I think it's Introduction to Poetry, is a great metaphor for helping people see the ways that we try to wrestle meaning out of poems and how we can sort of loosen up and not be so intent on squeezing something out of a poem, and rather than just experiencing it as a piece of art, just like you would a painting, where you stand in front of the painting and go, that makes me feel a certain way.
And is that a painting if it's only three gray lines on a white canvas, right? Well, this has been a really, really wonderful conversation. I wish I could hear you both read more of your wonderful collections, which again, for listeners, Katie Manning's collection that we've talked about in the podcast here is Herreverent. Heather Lanier's collection is Psalms of Unknowing, and it is presumably just out when this episode airs. So maybe we can have you guys back when you have your next collections out, or chapbooks, since now we know what that word means.
Thank you so much for having us. This was a delight.
Thank you. This was great.
Thanks so much.
If you enjoyed this conversation and you would like to learn more, please visit our website, englewoodreview.org, where you'll find plenty of book reviews, reading lists, and author interviews. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast through your favorite podcast provider and share it with your friends. Thank you again for listening. Here's to energizing reading today.